you very much. Marshall, if you could call court to order, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Johnson, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, February 3rd, 2022. We have five cases on our calendar today. This is the first of two set for oral argument. Thank you both for joining us via Zoom. We are holding this oral argument virtually, and we appreciate you accommodating us in this fashion. We will have this hearing recorded, so no other recordings are permitted, but it will be recorded and people can access it after the hearing. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments. Appellant, you will have, attorney for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose after. The typical rules, normal rules of decorum apply to this hearing as well. When one of you is speaking, please make sure that you're unmuted. The other person, please stay muted until it is your turn to speak. And if we do, because we are holding this virtually, on occasion we have run into issues with our technology despite our best efforts, both from attorneys and from the court as well. And if we do run into any issues, we will make sure that we accommodate the parties so that you each have your allotted time to present your arguments. So with that, attorney for appellant, if you can please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, you may proceed. And also there is one other thing I should mention is there will be a time clock that you should be able to see so you know how much time. Please be cognizant of that and watch that so you know how much time you have. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim McGeaney, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Midwest Bonding LLC. And I do appreciate the courts allowing us to appear on Zoom, especially on Minnesota days like this. Save us a trip to St. Paul from Rochester and from Duluth. So this matter is before this court on my appeal, my client's appeal of a denial of reinstatement and discharge of a bail bond, actually two bail bonds that were posted to ensure the defendant Stacia Coonrad's appearance in these criminal proceedings in St. Louis County District Court. I think it's important to note factually that the bonds at issue in this appeal and in the underlying district court action were appearance bonds only because there was lots of mention about Ms. Coonrad's violations of various conditions of release during the pendency of this case. In addition, I think the record is clear that Ms. Coonrad failed to appear for her sentencing hearing while released on the bonds at issue here. Both the respondent and the district court made mention of various prior failures to appear in the district court in its analysis on the Shetsky factors and the respondent in their brief, alleging that there's that the prior failures to appear by Ms. Coonrad somehow should be considered in the analysis. And I respectfully disagree that the history of Ms. Coonrad with the district court prior to my clients posting the bonds at issue here are very relevant in the Shetsky factors. I would like to also point out that the district court in its order appears to agree that the second and third Shetsky factors weigh in favor of reinstatement and discharge of the bond. In fact, in its order, it specifically says that the third factor weighs in favor of I think what the language the court used was slightly favors reinstatement. And in the court's analysis of the second Shetsky factor, the good faith of my client, the surety, has weighed against the willfulness of Ms. Coonrad. The court makes a statement that it says the factor favors forfeiture, and then it goes on to say on page 4 of its order, it's in my addendum, and while petitioner may have had good faith as measured with the defendant's willfulness to appear, acknowledging actually the factor weighs in favor of reinstatement, then goes on again to talk about Ms. Coonrad's prior history prior to 2019 in determining ultimately that that factor should weigh against reinstatement and discharge of the bond.
Counsel, I'd like to talk to you about the second and third factors, the ones you were just focusing on. Would you agree that the second factor is the good faith of the bond company as measured by the fault or willfulness of the defendant, that case law establishes that?
I would, yes. Although okay. I think there's a difference. I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
In your brief, it seemed like you kind of conflated the second and third factors in the analysis. So I just want to make sure we're clear on the second factor. And so certainly the efforts of the good faith efforts of the bond company are relevant to the third factor, and you make a good argument about those. But as to the second factor, how did the district court abuse its discretion in finding that that factor favors forfeiture of the bonds, where clearly the record establishes that her non-appearance was willful?
Well, I would point to a couple of things. I'd point the court to a Minnesota Supreme Court decision that, and it's State v. Storkamp, and it's cited in my brief, where the Supreme Court discusses that the fact that a offender is willfully failing to appear doesn't necessarily outweigh the good faith efforts. And I think that's my argument. But in addition, I think the district court abused her discretion when she, first of all, relied on facts that are outside the record. On page 4 of the district court's order, she discusses the defendant's willful disobeying of court orders to cooperate with counsel and the public defender dispositional advisor. There's nothing in the record to support those findings. In addition, then the district court goes on to rely on the previous history in its analysis of this factor. So I believe that's where it's abused its discretion in its analysis of the second factor and failing to consider the holding in Storkamp that was clear that the Supreme Court in Storkamp discusses the fact that they never intended for this factor to automatically be considered as against reinstatement just because an offender is willfully outside the jurisdiction of the court. And I'd like to address this issue about how long the defendant was outside the jurisdiction of the court. The district court keeps citing these numbers that when the defendant was at large on warrant status for hundreds of days, and the state and respondent kind of criticizes my client or appellant for not being aware that the offender was in custody in South Dakota. It's interesting that my appellant's fugitive recovery agent, and it's in our affidavit, which is unrefuted, by the way, there was no response of pleadings filed in the district court. We were in touch with law enforcement in advising them of our efforts to locate Ms. Coonrad while she was fighting extradition in South Dakota, and yet no one advised our client that Ms. Coonrad was in custody. When we filed our petition, the state didn't file any responsive pleadings to indicate that she was in custody. We didn't learn that she was in custody until the hearing before the district court judge. The district court gave Ms. Coonrad custody credit for 263 days in her sentencing order. It's the index number 170 in the public record that was provided to this court from the district court in the transmittal. And Ms. Coonrad actually was questioning the custody credit in index number 178. The district court reaffirmed that they gave her credit for the South Dakota custody time. So, and that goes to the prejudice argument. The state acknowledged at the hearing that they weren't prejudiced for having to extradite Ms. Coonrad or do the work that was required to obtain the rendition warrant to extradite her, but yet complains about the lengthy time that it took to get her sentenced. She was in effect serving her sentence in South Dakota when she was apprehended in February because she got jail credit for all that time. So both the district court and respondent assert that the delays in sentencing caused prejudice to the state. I've cited some case law in my brief, and I won't take your time to go through that, where there's been other instances where an offender was at large pending sentencing, and this court found that the purpose of bail satisfied. You know, the Stelkamp case, which I cited.
Mr. McGinney, going back to the argument that you just made about jail credit, I don't recall seeing that in your brief. Did I miss that?
No, I did. I wasn't aware of it in my brief. It came to my attention after I filed my brief when I got some supplemental disclosures that came through the Odyssey filing system. I wasn't aware that Ms. Coonrad was litigating jail credit in the underlying case until after the briefs were already filed. And I went back and reviewed the Mensis record and saw that. But it is part of this court. It is part of the record that was transmitted. I looked it up in the notice that we got in the transmittal of the district court record to this court and confirmed that those documents were transmitted to this court. I just wasn't aware of it at the time. So I did not argue that in my brief. But
at the end of the day, though, the individual, the defendant was not sentenced between the original sentencing date of January 26th and until June 2nd, correct?
That's correct.
So the number of days that the district court has in its order, I believe, is in the, there's a reference to in the first factor that she was on warrant status for 126 days. So that's approximately correct, right?
I would agree. And I'd like to point out that the 126 days that she was on warrant status, approximately 100 of those days she was in custody in South Dakota. You know, this court found in Stelmach, which is cited in my brief, an offender at large for 90 days after a guilty plea and then apprehended and sentenced, the purpose of bail satisfied. Stelmach wasn't even in custody. She was at large for the 90 days between her failure to appear in the sentencing, where Coonrad here was in custody for the majority of the time that she was on warrant status and, in fact, got custody credit. You know, this court's found a 90-day absence between plea and sentencing. The purpose of bail was satisfied. Here, even it's 126 days, so it's a bit more than 90. But the majority of these days, that the offender was in custody and received custody credit. So I would argue that the purpose of bail satisfied when Ms. Coonrad was apprehended less than a month after she failed to appear and being held in custody.
It wasn't due to the efforts of the bonding company.
No, she was apprehended by another law enforcement agency in South Dakota. It wasn't due to any efforts by any Minnesota law enforcement agency.
How is the purpose of bail met in that instance?
Well, because she's back available and in custody. Like most offenders who abscond from the jurisdiction of the district court, it's a small percentage who are actually apprehended by the surety. The surety makes their efforts, and this court's found that good faith efforts don't necessarily need to include apprehension.
But counsel, if I might stop you there, I want to make sure that we're not conflating the different Chesky factors, because you're talking about good faith efforts. That goes by the bonding company. That goes to factor number three. And I think we're talking about factor number one here, which goes to the purpose of bail. And one of the things that we can look at for that is whether the surety has located, arrested, and returned the defendant. And I think that's where the district court said you didn't return the defendant. So that's why that factor does not weigh in favor of the bail company.
Well, it's true that the surety did not ultimately apprehend the defendant, but the first factor is the purpose of bail, civil nature of the proceedings, the cause, purpose, and length of the defendant's absence. It's not necessarily addressing who apprehends the defendant.
If you look at the Stork Camp case, it does talk about wanting to make sure that one of the purposes is to encourage the bail company to locate, arrest, and return the defaulting defendant. So that is, I think, under that first factor, why isn't that an appropriate fact for the district court to consider?
Well, it's one of the facts to consider, but if you consider all the factors, the totality of the circumstances under the first factor, the circumstances here are similar actually more favorable to the surety than other cases that where this court's found the purpose of bail satisfied when an offender was apprehended by someone other than the surety. So, and I think all the factors, Your Honor, are need to be intertwined, right? I don't know that we can analyze one factor in on its own. So the really the most of the appellate cases on the first factor talk about the length of the defendant's absence.
And to that question, I have a question. How do we measure the absence? Because the state notes in their brief that from the time of charging to the time of sentencing or conviction, sentencing, it was over 1,000 days. But they previously argued that you look at the 126 days. You argue we should look at roughly the 30 days or so from the time that she absconded to the time that she was in jail in South Dakota. How do we calculate that? And what case law supports whatever calculation you advocate for?
Well, I think the calculation is from the date that the offender fails to appear, not from the date that the case was charged. There's so many different factors that could account for delay in a case that's not appropriate. The case law cited, I would point the court to Farsdale versus Minnesota and State v. Askland as two cases that talk about the length of the defendant's absence after they failed to appear. And I just cited the Stelmach case, which is another case, although not precedential, that I think all those cases mostly discuss the length of time the defendant's absent on the bond when they failed to appear, not from the date the case is charged. I see I'm out of time, so I'll reserve any additional argument for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your argument. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed.
All right. May it please the court, I am Brandon Schapansky, and I represent the respondent in this matter. The district court did not abuse its discretion when it denied appellant's petition. The appellant has failed to demonstrate that any of the four Shetsky factors weigh in his favor.
Well, counsel, can I stop you there? Because I think the district court did find that the third factor did weigh in favor of appellant bonding company.
Correct. So they found that it minimally or slightly favored them. My argument would be that factor is not in their favor. So I guess I would disagree with the district court on that. But overall, I would agree with the ultimate court's conclusion on all four factors.
Well, but on the third factor, we look at the reasonable efforts. And they not only undertook efforts themselves and have affidavits to that, but they also hired a company to do searches and try to find the person. So do you disagree that they actually, with the district court's analysis, that they did indeed undertake reasonable efforts under the third factor?
I would say that they took efforts, but whether they're reasonable efforts, I would say no.
What case law support do you have for this? Because it does seem that they did undertake reasonable efforts when we look at other cases, as the cases you cited and you argue, token efforts. These don't seem like token efforts. They do seem like more than minimal efforts to try to find her.
I guess I know the district court cited the Langhaven case, which I understand is unpublished, but given the district court did rely on that in their discretion, in that case, there were merely token efforts. I don't dispute that appellant, that they did made efforts to locate Ms. Coonrad. I just don't think they were up to the level of, I guess, reasonable. The affidavit that they filed by Mr. Stussy basically stated that they looked at addresses and phone numbers and social media. Other than that, there was no detailed documentation, such as an invoice showing specifically what they did to make those efforts reasonable in order to find her.
Counsel, you don't have any case law that suggests that these efforts to support your view that these efforts weren't reasonable, do you? I mean, is there any case that suggests that these are not good faith efforts? Because they're certainly, you know, potentially they could have done more, but they did undertake a number of efforts to locate the individual.
I don't specifically. I would just note that the district court in their order stated a slightly favor. And I guess I just based off the facts on the record is what I would be arguing is that even though they were in good faith, they were merely token efforts to, like I said, make phone calls, check the addresses and look on social media.
Can we turn to the first factor? Oh, go ahead, Judge Reyes.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'd like to turn your attention to the first factor, which is one of the factors that appellant is arguing the district court abused its discretion on. Appellant argues that the district court shouldn't have considered prior failures to appear, and in your brief, you recognize that the district court, you know, made a mistake in terms of the citing six prior failures to appear when it was actually four. But, you know, regardless of the precise number, was it appropriate for the district court to consider prior failures to appear in that factor?
I do, Your Honor. I believe that the prior failure to appear go towards the, cause of defendant's absence in considering whether or not the cause of her absence was, you know, mistake or whether it was willful or purposeful. I mean, the purpose of bail is to assure that Ms. Kunat would reappear, which appellant simply did not achieve with this. And so I believe the district court was correct in finding that using the prior fail to appears as a reason for the cause and length of defendant's absence as a whole.
Do you have any case law to support that position?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
I'm sorry. Do you have any case law to support that position that you can look at the prior absences to support the cause element of the first factor?
I do not. And I guess that the prior fail to appear, I believe, would go more towards the second factor where you actually measure the fault and willfulness of the defendant. I think that's for that in order to determine for a district court to determine whether or not it was willful or they're at fault using prior fail to appears. You know, it goes to show that this last fail to appear was not in good faith and that it was a willful not appearance. One thing I would like to mention that I know Mr. McGinney stated in his argument, regarding the jail credit in South Dakota, Ms. Kunat was in South Dakota for that long period of time. However, she did not receive credit at her sentencing for jail credit when she was held on a South Dakota case. Once South Dakota released her on their hold, yeah, she did sit in South Dakota waiting extradition, and she did receive credit for that portion, but she did not receive credit for the entire month and a half that she was in that county jail.
Is that even relevant to the analysis of the factors?
I don't believe it is. I just know when Mr. McGinney stated it, I believe it was incorrect. I just wanted to clarify that was not what happened.
Counsel, I'd like to go to the last factor, the prejudice to state. And you argue, it appears there's kind of a general argument that you know, of course, well, that the district court said, you know, justice was certainly delayed in this case, but it seems to be a conclusory argument. And I'm having trouble finding what your specific prejudice is to the state here, especially when the person, the defendant did not appear for sentencing. So she already pleaded guilty. There wasn't a need for witnesses or anything to that effect. It all that needed to be done was determine what her final sentence was. So what is the prejudice? What is the specific prejudice to the state in this case?
I guess the prejudice to the administration of justice is, you know, justice is not served until the sentences laid out by the court. And in this case, Ms. Kunrat's incarcerated in prison. This is a serious first degree drug sale case. And, you know, delaying the justice, the administration of justice for sentencing and conviction be entered and Ms. Kunrat be out of society, I guess, the delay is prejudicial to the state and society as a whole.
But that's just that's what we're looking for, to see what is the prejudice to the state in terms of the administration of justice. And usually what we look at is to see, for example, let's say if the person absconded before trial and there's a delay, the delay is causing witnesses to lose the recollection of the events. The state is running into issues trying to locate witnesses. Those types of facts. But all I see is the general, administration of justice here. What are the specific facts that support the state's argument that it was prejudiced in its trying to administer justice here?
Your Honor, the state had to expend resources, not the bond company, in returning Ms. Kunrat back to Minnesota. I understand she has a right to fight extradition, and that is not at the fault of appellant. However, the process of getting a governor's extradition warrant and then having our sheriff's office have to transport her back to Becker County and not the appellant, you know, county and state resources were expended by, as a result of her not appearing for her sentencing hearing.
But didn't the state acknowledge that extradition alone wasn't really prejudicial?
Correct. The extradition itself was not prejudicial. However, I meant extradition process, but the actual transporting her back from South Dakota back up to here to Becker County, you know, there was state resources expended as a result of that.
But isn't that part of the extradition process?
Yeah, it is. I guess
so.
Would those expenses have been incurred if the bond company had, you know, if she had appeared as required under the bond?
No, if she would have appeared under the bond, there would have been no need to go through that process of transporting her back here. And one thing I want to mention on that Farsdale case that Mr. McGinney talked about, the facts in that case are different. In that case, the defendant was in Texas, and the court permitted the defendant to go to Texas. And up until that fail to appear point, that defendant was cooperative, had made all their court appearances. And so there was no reason for anyone to believe that he would invade the administration of justice. I think that's totally opposite of this case. Ms. Kunrat, she had a bad track record up until this point of the last fill to appear. And I just think the facts are not similar to apply to this case.
Counsel, given the fact that at least one factor, the third factor, favored Palin Bonding Company and potentially even the prejudice may not have been proven here, why didn't the district court abuse its discretion by, if not reinstating all of the bond, why not reinstate at least a portion of it? Because the district court does have the discretion in weighing the factors. And if the district court was correct that at least one factor favored bond company, why is that not an abuse of discretion to at least reinstate a portion of it? Especially, we're not talking a $2,000 bond here. We're talking $100,000 total. It's not an insignificant amount of money there.
I guess the district court would not have abused its discretion if there were two factors in favor of responding to an appellant, because essentially it's the court's discretion of how much, whether or not they do 10% or none. So based off of the district court's findings that it was bad faith, non-appearance of Ms. Kunrat, and I just believe that the court applied the facts of the case and what's on the record and made it use its discretion to find that the entirety of the bond should be forfeited rather than a portion or percentage.
But doesn't that work contrary to the whole purpose of a bond? If a bonding company does engage in good and reasonable efforts, good faith efforts to try to find the person, and yet they forfeit, then the district court forfeits the entire bond. Isn't that contrary to the whole purpose of the bonding statute? What's the incentive then for bonding companies to even put up bond for defendants if their good faith efforts are not even taken into account? Seems contrary to the whole purpose.
Yeah, Your Honor, I understand your point. I think obviously a bondsman has that duty to make good faith efforts to locate the defendant. Otherwise, you know, if they didn't make the good faith efforts, there's a chance that the defendant would never be found and their bond would be forfeited, or in the opposite, they could find the person and have it reinstated and discharged. I guess I don't know the answer to that. I understand that the court could have not done the entirety of the bond and gave some more credit to the appellant for the good faith efforts that they found. But I think it's important to just to remember that in this case, Ms. Coonrat, there was a prior bail bond that was reinstated to appellant. I know it's not the one that was forfeited that's in front of the court today, but I believe that's important to consider, for the court to consider, because this same judge already reinstated and discharged a bond to appellant. And then fast forward a year later, this exact same thing happens again. At that point, the court forfeits the entire bond. Other than that, Your Honors, if there's other questions, based on the district court's order, I believe that they were within their discretion and forfeiting the appellant's bond. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And if you, we can't hear you, it looks like you're on mute.
The wonders of Zoom, pardon me. You'd think after 2 years I'd be better at this. I would like to address the prejudice factor and remind this court, you already know, that the burden was on the state to prove prejudice. And I know Judge Reyes was inquiring about what specific prejudice has the state shown. The district court acknowledged in its order that the state didn't present any evidence of prejudice. The state acknowledged and conceded at the hearing that the extradition itself was not prejudicial and shouldn't be. And yet the court and respondent are arguing this general justice delayed to support a finding of prejudice. And clearly the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that the type of prejudice that respondent would need to show as the court was inquiring is loss of evidence, inability to prosecute the case. And here, Ms. Coonrat had already pleaded guilty when she failed to appear. And again, and I argued this earlier, while there was a delay in pronouncing sentence and issuing a sentencing order, it didn't affect the state's ability, one, to incarcerate her, because she was always incarcerated. She wasn't taking up the space in a Minnesota correctional facility but she was incarcerated, and therefore, you know, justice was not, she wasn't out there committing new crime that we're aware of. And the states failed to carry their burden on prejudice, and the district court abused its discretion when it found.
I'd just like to ask you about a statement you made earlier in that regard. You said that there's Supreme Court precedent that suggests that for this factor, we only consider prejudice in terms of on, you know, the effect on witness availability and that type of thing. What case were you referring to?
Your Honor, I would refer this court to the Shatsky case. And in addition, State v. Storkamp, and I'll cite the case. It says, when the prosecution provides evidence that it was deprived of proof or otherwise adversely affected because of the defendant's unexcused absence. And that's Storkamp and the State v. Askland as well, that I think Askland's the case that, you know, clears up that it's the state's burden of proof here. And again, you know, this is a civil proceeding. The state didn't file any responsive pleadings to the petition, no affidavits, no exhibits, merely came to the hearing and argued that they've been prejudiced because of the delay.
So, counsel, I agree with you that it's the state's burden, but do any of the cases that you just cited to us consider whether a delay in sentencing can result in prejudice to the state?
Not that I'm aware of.
So they don't really get to the issue before us then?
Well, I think that the issue is whether the issue on prejudice is whether the state's shown proof. And I think clearly here they have not carried their burden. You know, the state relies on Vang, and that's a case where the appellate court found that there was prejudice because Mr. Vang was never apprehended and never sentenced. And so in arguing that Vang is appropriate here, Vang is a case where the court, where this court held this prejudice by the delay, but the delay was never ending. Here, Ms. Coonrad was in custody, and it was just a matter of getting the extradition process completed and having her brought over to Minnesota to be sentenced. I'd also like to address the state's argument that the resources expended. I think the district court in its order says the court may not consider the financial consequences. And we offered to pay at the hearing. My client offered to pay the cost of extradition, which the state certainly has the right to request under Minnesota statute. And they didn't. And we offered to pay their expenses and continued to offer the expenses. But rather than have us pay the expense of extradition, the court forfeited a $100,000 bail bond. And I think Judge Reyes is correct. That's kind of draconian, especially when it's well decided that the purpose of bail is not to punish the surety. This is one of those cases where the court's punishing the surety by forfeiting a $100,000 bail bond because the defendant had to be extradited rather than just voluntarily waived extradition. I see I'm out of time, so unless the court has any more questions, I'm happy to answer.
Does not look like anybody else has any questions. Thank you, counsel, both of you, for your oral argument.